This is FM 100.5 and 101.9, AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
Good afternoon, Rutherford County. I hope everybody is inside. I hope your air condition's working. And it's one of those days that you just need to make sure you got plenty of liquids available and stay out of the sun. Unless you happen to be looking for a car. And if you are, I know the place to go. If you'll just take about a 20-minute ride at 231 South, and on your left, just before you get into the city limits of Shevable, you'll see a sign that says Pirtle and Howerton Automotive. And that address is 2006 North Main Street in Shevable. And if you want to, you can call them before you leave at 1-800-264-6800 or on the internet, PirtleHowerton.com. And if you're looking for a Ford, Mercury, Chevrolet, Buick, or GMC, that's the place to go. And if you're just looking and want to get out in your car and drive around with the air conditioning going and find another place that's got air conditioning, let's take a ride out that way. Well, we have Mr. Greg Tucker on again. This is our ever other Tuesday. And it seems like, Greg, that before the day, the 2 days before you come on our show, you always have something in the paper, an interesting story. Is that done on purpose, or is it just an accident?
Well, it's a consequence of a very conscious decision. When you and I were talking about me coming on once every 2 weeks, I thought, well, I'll put you in the week that I'm not writing a column. So I have just written a column, and the column's run, and then we get together.
Yeah, and it's always an interesting story. And I don't know how... Do you spend a lot of your time researching, or is this a continuing process with you? And where do you get your sources?
Well, it's very much a continuing process, because I learned early on you've got to plan ahead, because you can't, oops, that story didn't come together and not have something. So I'm thinking or working on two or three all the time. And when I've got some time, no matter where I am in terms of a deadline, is I'll go to the library, go to the archives, go to the state archives, or line up an interview with somebody who may have particular knowledge of it. So
because you do write and your name's in front of the people all the time, and because you're on this show, I know there are a number of people that will call you that may be interested in a subject that really maybe they don't have the time or the ability to get out and do some of those researches.
Well, part of the thing that makes it, for me, just very entertaining, very satisfying, is almost every time a story runs, I'll get a phone call or two or an email. This morning I had a delightful conversation with the son of an individual that we wrote about on Sunday, Norman Hutchinson. And well, we had the best time talking and getting acquainted, and it turns out late in the conversation, he mentioned Clyde Fite. And of course,
the old city manager.
Yeah, well, there was a decade or so there when it seemed like once or twice every week at dinner, my father would make reference to Clyde Fite, because he, of course, was doing a lot of the architectural work for the city. And so I asked Norman this morning, I said, well, you might remember an architect. And he remembered Bernie Lee and started telling me stories about my daddy. And I told him, I said, you know, it'll make my day anytime somebody will say something nice or remember something about my father.
There's one thing that's one thing I was going to ask you. You haven't done very many stories about your dad, as far as what I can tell. I mean, you haven't gotten really into the meat of it, and I think that it would be enjoyable for all of us to be able to read that.
Well, back in the early 90s, let's see, it would have been 93, 94, we were all over the country, people were observing the 50th anniversary of World War II. Wow. And I was relatively new back in the community at the time. We had just moved back here in 88, 89. But I use that 50th anniversary as an occasion to write about my father's experience in World War II. And what I did was about, I think I did 8 or 10 episodes. It did appear in the Daily News Journal. They were delighted to run it. And I just took the 50th anniversary of when the squadron, the famous Black Sheep, were founded, and then took it through, as we reach another 50th anniversary mark of, that period, right about it. And I actually wrote, I think, 14 of 16 chapters that I had outlined, and I've been sitting on it ever since. But
when are you going to quit sitting on it?
Yeah, I have already pulled out some of the material and began to refresh so we can finish that off.
What did he think about the movie or in the I think there's a television show on that too.
Yeah, and I watched the tape of the pilot two nights ago, trying to catch up. I was in college and saw in the paper somewhere, an entertainment magazine, that a new series was going to run on the Black Sheep, World War II Pacific Marine Squadron. So next time I talked to my father, it was a couple of days later, I said, "Have you seen that?" And he says, "Oh, no, surely not." And I said, "Yeah, apparently they've already got the pilot together, and it's going to be running here pretty soon."
He would have thought he would have been happy.
Well, as you would expect, and as he expected, it was going to be a Hollywood treatment.
Of course.
Of course. And he was, like a lot of us are who have a special knowledge, like I have a terrible time with movies about lawyers and trial because Hollywood does its way, and it can't be done that way, and it always throws you. Well, he had a time with World War II movies because they'd always have the planes, and you'd see a plane take off, and then they'd show the plane in the air, and it'd be a different plane, different kind of plane. Or I can remember one time him watching.
Only somebody like that would notice it, though.
Yeah. Of course, he had been trained to know the silhouettes and the instant recognition of the planes and all. And I can remember watching something with him, and he said, "Oh my gosh, those planes weren't anywhere in the South Pacific. They flew over Europe only." So that was his sensitivity. And he, up to that time, like most World War II veterans, didn't talk much about it.
Yeah,
I mean. To
it's
me,
in
the 1960s, World War II was already, as far as I was concerned, ancient history. But you think now, 20 years back, we're talking about 1990. That's just yesterday for you and me.
Yeah.
So in the 60s, it was still very close in the consciousness of those World War II veterans.
They saw things that humans are not supposed to endure.
I know it. The experience there.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's always been the nature of war when you read about the Civil War in this area. Just incredible, the loss and the damage and destruction. But anyway, when it started, his reaction was just as he expected. Is this ridiculous? First of all, there were no women within 500-600 miles, and the ones that were there were all the native women.
Right.
And some of
and that was stationed, and they were stationed at...
Well, they start out Espirito Santo down the South Pacific,
right, okay.
And then in the pilot, they, of course, changed the names around some, but in the pilot...
And that is not my telephone going off this time.
I'm turning mine off. Sorry. In the movie, they changed the names, but they had them move up and base on one island and sit there, and everybody's plane had his name on it, and... my father remembers that we didn't know hardly from day to day where we're going to be based next because we were chasing the retreating Japanese. So, we'd clear an island, the ground forces would go in and mop up, and then the CBs would go in and clean up. And if you wanted souvenirs, you always dealt with the CBs because they got there to gather up the bodies and remove
that was them. A tough job.
Yeah, it was a tough. I imagine it was, but Pop said when they would finally hit the island, because it'd be the next wave come in to set up their air base for the next step. In fact, they call it the stepping stones to Japan. If you wanted a souvenir, you'd deal with the CBs before they left because they'd have daggers and guns.
Did he say anything about them actually having film of what they were doing at the time? Because I know in a lot of the battle areas, they had people that worked in the military that's all they did was film the action that was going on.
I have a picture of my father, two of his pilot mates, and a fourth fella. And it confused me for a long time. So after my father died, and I began to study some of what we had. Finally, I talked to one of the other pilots who was in the picture, still living today. And it was a photographer, a movie photographer, who was part of the Marines.
Right.
And his job was to be in the midst of what was going on. This was not film they were releasing to the public at all. Mm-hmm. It was documentation for the military purposes. And my father and his bunkmates had befriended this particular one, and they took him up several times, you know, so he could get aerial shots and such. So, yeah, somewhere there's probably, if it's been preserved, I hope it has, a very detailed library of film of the Black Sheep and probably every other squadron.
I'm surprised they haven't released some of that, because I do know that, especially in the Marines and the Navy, they had people, and once they were assigned their jobs, which was to make sure they captured all the events that were going on, they weren't allowed to do anything but that. I mean, if the place was, if the ship was on fire, or no matter what was going on, their number one job was to preserve that for history. And, and I think that was somebody had some great forethought for that.
Well, I think part of the problem is, though, that so much was coming in. Of course, they were distracted with the active war effort, that it just piled up somewhere, probably in the basement of the Pentagon somewhere. Because today, if you go to the trouble of looking for it and identifying it and sorting through and finding it, it is accessible. You know, public record, but everybody I've talked to says it takes you know, you gotta work full time to find what you're looking for, but somewhere it is. We asked about my father after the series started. He started he was contacted. I'm not even sure who tipped him off, but somebody here in Murfreesboro with a newspaper called him and said, well, we'd like to do an interview. And he essentially said, well, if you're looking for stories like what you're seeing on TV, don't waste your time. They said, no, 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 we want the real story. So he did an interview, and then he started getting requests for speaking at the luncheon clubs and the Moose Club and places like that, and he began to enjoy that. He always started by saying, now listen, the first thing I want to tell you is, if you've been watching that show, we didn't have fun. He said, I don't remember it being near that much fun as they make out. You know, we had our moments, but it wasn't fun. And clearly, in the pilot, they've got the nurses, and they've got them sneaking into the hospital nurses. And he says, you know, there wasn't a nurse within 1,000 miles of where we were. And
if you've been through that, and you know what the truth is, it kind of smacks you in the face.
Yeah, it gets you. But he began to enjoy, you know, talking to people. And the governor called him in, made him a colonel and all, Tennessee colonel, whatever it was. And I think in part he appreciated it because he was an architect, and you know, it helped expand the people and contacts and all, and generate some business. But it's funny now, or funny or ironic, that they're replaying those Black Sheep serials on the History Channel. And, you know, there's a little bit of history in that pilot, you know, how it got started and that kind of thing. But beyond that, they are purely Hollywood scripts.
That's unreal.
And yet they're showing them, or they were. I don't know, they may have exhausted it, but for a while they'd show them on a History Channel and
the Military Channel. Did they show it on that one?
I don't know about the military.
I think that would be a little bit more accurate, because I've watched that, and they seem to be on the button.
Yeah.
Well, and they do have a lot of film that are actual
using
films.
Yeah, that's where they're using it. Well, on the History Channel, they would then invite one or two of the Black Sheep, and this 10 years ago, there were several of them still available. And after the movie, you know, they'd sit and talk about it. And that helped some, because the guys would laugh and say, well, I sure don't remember anything quite like that. And then they would start asking them questions about, well, what really, you know. But my father had died before that started. So and I think he would have enjoyed that, because there were things that he'd like to have straightened out.
That would be a neat book for you to complete.
Well, part that I hadn't written was the last part, which was going to be the aftermath, because Boyington was good. Gregory Boyington, I'm a namesake, they called him Pappy. he was good at fighting. Mm-hmm. And if he wasn't fighting the Japanese and flying, he was obviously very, very good at flying, having flown with the Flying Tigers. He had more experience than anybody in the South Pacific. But that's all he was good at. And the rest of his life was bouncing from one thing to another. And one time he was trying to make a living as a wrestling referee.
Wow.
On the studio wrestling, which, you know, is staged.
That had been tough.
Yeah, and he was traveling with them, and they would, you know, live studio wrestling tonight at such and such, the Hippodrome in Nashville, mm-hmm. or something like that, usually a kind of a low venue. And then down at the bottom, it would say, featuring Gregory Pappy Boyington, Medal of Honor winner, U.S. Marines, such and such. And he tried selling insurance for a while. In fact, he aggravated my father because my father went out of his way one time to meet him when he came through Phoenix, where we were living at the time. And, you know, to talk about old times and all Boyington wanted to do was try to sell him insurance, and kind of aggravated him. And by the time fellas got around to their first reunion, which was held out in Hawaii, after the show had kind of run its course, a significant number of the black sheep were just so aggravated with Boyington because he had made money off the show. Mm-hmm. He had been the advisor, and it was based on his book and his life story. So he had, and the rest of them, of course, didn't get anything, although I don't think they really wanted it. They just kind of resented that Boyington was getting compensated for making up stories about them. And some of them felt like he was putting them in a bad light because, you know, in the show, they're all pulled out of court-martial. And that wasn't quite true. Many of them were replacement pilots. My father was a replacement, just hadn't been assigned yet, waiting in the pool. Others were from squadrons that had been broken up because they had lost the leadership. So they were a bunch of kind of pickup pilots, and that's exactly how he formed it. It was probably the only squadron in the Pacific, if not the whole war, that was not formed in the States, mm-hmm. trained in the States, shipped over as a unit, and essentially shipped with their planes, because they knew the black sheep ended up flying a plane that none of them had ever even seen before. You know, 3 weeks before going into combat, they get this new plane, which of course turned out to be one of the reasons for their success, the Corsair. But the Corsair had just been rejected by the Navy, because when they tried to land on an aircraft carrier, they're killing too many pilots. The thing were very difficult to control on landing. So the Navy, which was looking for a plane that could fly off the aircraft carriers, refused to take the Corsair. They literally dumped it over on the Marines. And I did read through the log kept by the information officer, which detailed every time that they flew. And for the first week or so, they tore up a few planes. My father wrecked the first plane. He managed to flip it, and it was on landing. He says they performed well taking off. It was a beautiful bird in the air. But when they tried to land the thing, it would fishtail and buck all over the place. And hard to stop. You know, if you hit, he went off the end of the, they had these, what you and I'd call, I guess, chain mail that they'd stretch out across the jungle floor to make the airstrip. He ran off the end of it on into the jungle and flipped the thing over, tail over head, and was hanging upside down when they got to him. And they cut him out, and he was just fine, wasn't hurt at all, which improved everybody's morale. You know, you can survive these things. But the notation in the information officer's book was, plane was total loss. So they tore up several of them trying to figure out how to fly them. Another story that was commonly told was the first time two of them flew in after dark. And they were up there, two of them, in planes. It was Tom Emmerich and Harper from St. Louis. And Tom says, hey, Harpo, how you turn the lights on this thing? Harpo says, give me a minute, I'm looking. And, you know, while flying in the dark, they're feeling around and trying to find, and finally one of them found a light switch and got the lights on. And
the funny thing, why you're relating this to everybody out there, is that you actually have the real story about what went on there. And those of us that have seen the series, and the only name that we remember is Boynton. is Pappy Boynton.
Oh, that's true.
And of course, he's the one that related a lot of the episodes, yeah, as how they got it. And you think about that, all the heroes and all the people that contributed so many different things, you never hear of them.
Oh, that's true. And that was part of what, when he wrote his book, which of course was ghostwritten for him, but he dictated and told the stories. My father and a bunch of others that had been in the squadron were disappointed because he used a few names, primarily his closest drinking buddies. But my father went out and bought the book when it first came out and sat down and read it and put it up on a shelf and never said much more about it. Mm. And years later, I pulled that book down, flipped through it, and he had underlined passages in there. And I asked him about it. He was still living at the time. I said, well, what's the underlining? And he said, that's me. Because there would be something where it would say, one pilot came in and reported that. And mm-hmm. in the detail what he reported. And he said, you know.
You would think that there would be a relationship between the Boynton and with every one of his pilots. I mean, you would think they would be just like family because of what they went through.
Well, they were, and they all felt that way, I think, particularly after Pappy disappeared. And but years later when he starts trying to capitalize on it, and again, I mean, this guy had no means of livelihood, really, mm-hmm. except his hero status and his fame. But he wrote the book and just didn't use the names.
That's one of the sad things about war, is that you have professional military people out there, and some of them are newcomers to it, mm-hmm. but they're out there doing extraordinary things every day, life and death situations where they hold a person's life in their hands or even their own, and they go through all that, and then they finally come to an end. And in our case, victory, and then they're put back into civilian life, and right. they're lost. Right. They have no idea what to do.
Right, and I think Pappy was very much like that. He had an alcohol problem. He married, I think, four times. His fourth wife, he was quite a bit along in years at that time. She really got a hold of him, though, and in his last years, again, being only that he was, he started going to the air shows and things like that, and selling. By then, there were other books about him and pictures and things of that sort. And my father, after they got reacquainted, and I guess in those last years, my father was probably his closest friend because he would bring him, well, he talked him into coming up to do the Smyrna air show. Mm-hmm. And he would stay at our home. And of course, I was long gone, but my son, my oldest son, had occasion to sit in his lap several times and get the stories and such. And they'd come together to the air shows, and Pappy would sit down with a stack of pictures, or there was even some records for recorded interviews and such, and sell them. Mm-hmm. And his wife would sit beside him with, you remember in the early days of the credit card, you had that funny thing that went
tick, oh, yeah.
back over the car.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, she had one of those where she could do a credit card.
Oh, my goodness.
And they made
the
it.
Lady had a business mind.
They had a business going, made a pretty good living. And he would, he always wanted my father sitting. Now I'm forgetting whether it's left or right side, but my mm-hmm. father in the second tour was his wingman whenever they were both flying.
That's who you counted on.
Yeah, he had to have him sit beside him at the table, and he would be signing and so on. And said, "You want to get this fella? He was my wingman. This is Tuck, is mm-hmm. what he called him." And I think they both had a good time. And then they died just very close together. My father died during the summer, and in January the following year.
Did they both quit flying altogether?
Yeah, pretty much at the end of the war. My father taught flying for a year and a half or so before he went back to college. And I don't think they'd let Pappy fly. I was at the Smithsonian. I worked out a appearance of the black sheep at the Smithsonian when they put the Corsair on display. That's another long story. But I remember... after all the details on the ceremony, then Boynton got up just to make a little talk and answer questions. And one of the first questions he got was from a child, looked like he's maybe 14, 13 years old. And he says, "Pappy, Do you think if you got back in one of them now, you could fly it? And Pappy didn't hesitate a minute. He says, absolutely. I'd get that thing up in the air in just a few minutes.
Just like riding a bicycle.
Just like riding a bicycle. And we got some good pictures. We put him up in the plane that they were putting on display and got some pictures.
Did they have actual control. Pictures of the original group there in the Smithsonian?
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to see that.
Well, there's the famous picture. Anybody who has ever studied or read about them, it shows a Corsair with those beautiful and quickly recognized inverted gull wing. Mm-hmm. You know, the wing came out of the plane, dropped down, and then angled back up. They call it an inverted gull. Seagull does that, but it's turned up the other way. And a bunch of them are standing up on the wings holding baseball bats, and they're all wearing, I think you and I have talked about this a little before, they're all wearing baseball caps. Mm-hmm. And Boyington and some of the seniors are out front with their caps and baseball bats. And every time I see the picture, it looks like someone has tried to come up with a way to explain what in the world they're doing with that. You know, like they enjoyed baseball in their time off. What had happened is the information officer, when they started getting all this good publicity, the St. Louis Cardinals, mm-hmm. our southern team back in those days, were the World Series champions. And he wrote to them and said, and he sent a box full of patches. I'd love to know what happened to all those black sheep patches. Sent to them and said, you know, you're the champions, you're the baseball champions, and we're the champions of the South Pacific. Mm-hmm. Let's do a trade. And they sent the baseball caps and the bats out to the South Pacific.
You know, something that's really interesting about, you talking about baseball in World War II, is a large number of professional baseball players actually joined and went into World War II in the military, and a lot of them went into the Air Force and, mm-hmm. and the Navy.
Well, it shut down the major leagues for a year or two. Mm-hmm. In fact, there was a movie some years ago. Madonna was in it, and it was about
a league of our own.
Yeah, about the girls playing. And again, it
probably All-American girls professional baseball.
Yeah, and it's probably like anything else Hollywood does. There wasn't much history there, but it was an entertaining mm-hmm. movie, and Madonna did look pretty good in baseball outfit. So,
well, I guess, if you say so. I was more into Gina Davis. I believe that's her name. She looked like a great athlete out there. And it's my understanding that they did have some pretty good ball players mm-hmm. in that professional league. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a long answer to a simple question. Yes, I've got a book in the works on what I have learned and know about the black sheep and their experience. And it's really just the last chapter, which was trying to explain relationship amongst them after the war and after they came back. That was where I kind of
that would be as interesting almost as the partner in the war.
Was a little more difficult to write because you're getting into more philosophical or psychological, the relationships and the reactions and that kind of thing. But yeah, we'll wind that one up. As you know, we got our second book out about a month ago,
and I read it. Great book.
So I'm looking forward to it.
But you still haven't done what I asked you to do.
Yeah, well, the fiction, the historical fiction.
Well, yeah, historical fiction, which I think would be a whole lot more accurate than what we see in Hollywood.
I would hope so.
In fact, you may even get a book out of it.
Yeah.
And it could probably do a series in Hollywood, kind of like the Harry Potter thing. They have 7 or 8 or 9 different movies. And
mm-hmm. Well, you know, Rutherford County is that interesting. There are that many stories.
Oh, it is.
There are that many stories. There could be a great series.
Now, while you're talking about that, you just brought up a sore subject with me. The historical vandalism that occurred in Mercer. Wasn't that the stupidest thing you have ever seen?
I drove by today and was glad to see that they were working on it, but they actually were getting it clean. I was concerned that some of that stuff soaks into that permeate, mm-hmm. the stone, and might not come off.
Do you think they'll be able to get it all out? Because what I was seeing yesterday, it was still bad.
It looked better than I thought it would, but it may continue.
Well, I think we have a caller in for Mr. Greg Tucker. Caller, welcome aboard.
Thank you. I just would like to know if Mr. Tucker knows if Dr. Neil Ellis was a member of this group.
Neil Ellis? a member?
Yes, he was chairman of the Department of Middle Tennessee State University in Industrial Studies.
Mm-hmm. I have read the roster several times, and I don't remember an Ellis name. And one reason I think it probably wasn't there is because Ellis is my mother's family name, or one
he
of the family names.
He was from Missouri,
name.
I think.
Yeah, I will check, but I don't recall an Ellis on the roster. Now, remember that all these squadrons, they're deactivated for a while, but then they're reactivated, and right now there is a Black Sheep squadron in the South Pacific, and I'm aware of it because my daughter is in the Marines, and she is working with not the Black Sheep, but another squadron. The Avengers, but she applied to be part of the Black Sheep, and they didn't have an opening in her specialty, so I know. So Ellis could well have been when they reactivated the Black Sheep in the world in Korea, or even today. But I'll check for you, and we'll talk about it next time I'm on.
Very good, and I really appreciate all the work you're doing in documentation. That means so much to our generations to come that it's factual. Also, Dr. Ellis would talk about that there was a certain length of years that he was not supposed to talk about his activities, and then after that, he did open up and begin talking about his experiences some.
Well, if that is the case and he actually was under some kind of order, or that would be the period immediately following the war when there actually was a lot of clandestine, secret activity going on while we tried to rebuild the defeated countries before the communist forces co-opted the position there. So that could well be.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just want to let people out there know that there's a special service that is given in this community. It's called At Home Care, and it's provided by Melissa Warren and her staff. And basically what they do, as our population has gotten older, and there seems to be more of a need for people, and especially when they want to stay home and be able to live in their own environment, they come in and they provide errands, laundry, personal needs, light housekeeping, transportation to appointments, grocery shopping, meal preparation, medication reminders, and many, many other things. And I'll tell you, their phone number is 713-4639, or you can reach them at www.athomecare.com. And their office is located at 237 Castlewood, Suite H. 237 Castlewood Drive, Suite H, and that's behind Kroger's on Memorial Boulevard. And if you're looking for that special need, please give them a call, and I think that it'll be well worth your while.
Hi, I'm Don Patterson, an internal medicine physician with Middle Tennessee Medical Group, a new multi-specialty office dedicated to the health and well-being of you and your family. Our physicians provide expertise in family and internal medicine, as well as other specialties. Middle Tennessee Medical Group offers two locations in Murfreesboro for your convenience. To make an appointment with a Middle Tennessee Medical Group physician, call 396-6800 or visit middletnmedicalgroup.com.
Hello, this is Jim Bryan at First Bank.
And I'm Chuck Lewis. First Bank presents Good Neighbor Events, news of what our local schools, churches, and community groups are doing.
Well, here it is Tuesday, and Good Neighbor Events brought to you by First Bank. A free ACT-SAT workshop over at the Patterson Community Center tonight at 5 o'clock. Absolutely free. Tonight's session deals with test strategies. Now, they need to know that you're coming, so call them at 907-3429. That ACT-SAT workshop tonight at 5 at the Patterson Community Center. And at 6 o'clock tonight, the Red Cross Disaster Volunteer Orientation, and that's over at the new Red Cross building. It's over on Memorial, the former Chamber of Commerce building. 6 to 7:30 tonight. If you're interested in volunteering with the Red Cross to help in disaster services, you need to be at that session tonight, 6 o'clock. Movies Under the Stars at 8:30 tonight. It's a free service of the Murfreesboro Parks and Recreation Department. It's 8:30 tonight at the Cannonsburg Village, and the film is the animated Yogi Bear. Like to remind you that the 21st Annual Omega Free Basketball Clinic is coming up Saturday, 10 until 2 Saturday, over at the Patterson Community Center. It's all free, including food, the T-shirt, everything. Now listen, MTSU head basketball coach Kermit Davis and the Blue Raider men's basketball team, they're going to be a part of the clinic. That's 10 until 2 this Saturday at SportsCom. And the Salvation Army's golf tournament's coming up Saturday at 2 o'clock over at the Champions Run Golf Course in Rockvale. This coming Saturday, call the Salvation Army right now and say, I want to be a part of that. 895-7071. Now remember to get those Good Neighbor events to us at least 2 weeks before they occur. WGNS Good Neighbor Events brought to you by First Bank.
Weather Eye. We'll see sunny skies in our forecast this afternoon, along with a slight chance for showers and storms. Expect hot and humid conditions with a high of 98, and we could have more storms tonight with a low of 76. I'm WGNS meteorologist Sam Donaisky. Right now, 99.
Guardian has over 125 years combined experience in security, fire, camera systems, and access control for your home and business. Contact Guardian at 459-1040 at mygss.com.
Guardian, we help you keep your guard up.
459-1040.
He knows Rutherford County as good as anybody. Truman Jones. It's The Truman Show here on WGNS AM and FM.
With today's guest, Greg Tucker.
Sausage and biscuits, gravy and grits, home ground, homemade, it'll get you fits. Blueberry pancakes and corn cakes too, I'm a-licking my lips now, how about you? Readyvo, readyvo, readyvo meal, I said get yourself to the readyvo meal.
I get to listen to this song and then I forget all about what I'm going to say. But of course, everybody knows that's John Blankenship and friends. And we have Mr. Avant Lane playing with him, Ken and Sarah Frizzell, Billy Yearwood. Of course, he's on the mandolin. And when I go over there, usually every Saturday morning, I enjoy going into the place and go to your right in the far back place. That's where the band is. But you can hear them all over the place, and what a wonderful atmosphere it is. And the Readyvo Mill, as everyone knows by now, is one of the few existing fully operational mills anywhere in the country, and it's in Readyvo, Tennessee, and it's on the old Woodbury Highway. But if you could take John Bragg, the new four lane, and take it all the way to about Cripple Creek and turn left there in the old Woodbury Highway and take it all the way to Readyvo, you will go in and experience a time that's long past, but the food is absolutely out of this world. And Tom Brady did such a great job refurbishing the mill. And it's just beautiful over there next to the running river. And Greg, you were telling me that one of our famous citizens here in Murfreesboro is heading out that way.
Well, talk about historic icons.
Yes.
I have it on good authority that Myers Parsons some of his family are going to be there this coming Saturday. And I believe Myers was there on site when they poured the foundation of the mill.
Originally?
At the beginning. Yeah, originally. If not, he's awfully close to it.
What was that, 1812, I believe, right? Somewhere around there?
Somewhere around in there.
Yeah. Well, bless his heart.
And
of course, he's going to have his whole family there. I guarantee you David and Myers will be there. What do you think?
I would be surprised if they weren't.
Free meal, all
that? I know. If your daddy along, you know his daddy.
Yes.
Yeah, you don't even have to bring your billfold.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right.
Yeah, but that's a good... we got a call coming in.
Yes. Caller, welcome aboard.
Good afternoon. I have a comment and then I have a question. First of all, I'm kind of okay with Hollywood doing their thing with history as long as it provokes people to get out and research and read and be interested
in
those types of things. But I personally wish that they would bring back the draft for men and women to serve at some capacity right out of high school. But I'm curious, Mr. Tucker, was your father drafted? and if he was or if he was not, what was his opinion on the draft? And I'm going to hang up so that I can hear you clearly. Thank you.
They were drafting very heavily as my father was finishing his second year at what then was State Teachers College here in Murfreesboro. And everyone that had a birthday on or before June 30th of 1920 had to go register for the draft. My father was born on June 30th, 1920. And he went in and registered, mm-hmm. and he said, I remember hearing him, he did tell me this story. He says, yeah, I went in and registered, and I handed it in, and the fellow in charge there looked at it and laughed real big and said, boy, we just barely got you, didn't we? And my father said, I didn't think it was one bit funny at all. But what he did, what many of them did, and I think most of them were probably motivated out of patriotism, mm-hmm. loyalty, and anger that, you know, we had been attacked. And, of course, they knew that they were going to be drafted. He immediately went and joined the Navy because he wanted to fly. He had wanted to fly all his life and had been flying some at the school. And so he got in ahead of the draft, but I'm sure he would have been drafted if he hadn't, and that was part of the motive. But by joining, he was able to get into more of what he wanted, and he had 2 years of college, which was enough to get him into an officer status. So he went in that way. The only time he and I ever discussed the merits of the draft was during the Vietnam War period when it was hanging over me. And he was anxious for me to avoid being drafted. And I think he had some negative feelings about it because of the nature of that conflict, mm-hmm. and the confusion about what we were trying to do and whose interests we were protecting. And he counseled me to join the Navy. I had almost joined the Marines just, you know, to follow him, but he counseled me to join the Navy so that I could avoid at least having to be on the ground.
Well, I can address that, too, because I was drafted in the Vietnam era, and I still remember when I got my draft notice, and it was in November of 63, and I had just, I had gone boar hunting, and... When I got it back, I mean, I was the target then. But I can tell you, going into the service when you're that young, it's a great experience. It really is. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're only talking about 2 years, which was mm-hmm. well, the draft status was at that time. And you go in and you become a whole lot more responsible by the time you get out than when you went in.
You do grow up very fast.
You grow up very fast and of course, as you know, they did away with the draft mm-hmm. after that. And I can agree with the lady because I think that it did provide a great service. And I think that it did give young men a chance to grow up and do some things they normally wouldn't have been able to do. And I think it when they did away with it, I think it did take away some of the feelings of responsibility and accountability mm-hmm. and those things like that. So mm-hmm. I can agree with her.
And I think there are some European countries that do have a service requirement mm-hmm. That's both men and women. My feeling is I think it would be good if we had a public service requirement, mm-hmm. 2 years out of high school or sometime in that period for everybody. Everybody's not suited to military, but there's right. something everybody can do to contribute to the country.
That's new skills going in that right, they normally wouldn't have.
Right, and it would help quite a bit, I think, with the, I mean, high school graduates' unemployment rate is just out of sight right now. And the type of jobs you get frequently, flipping hamburgers and all, is not necessarily developing skills you're going to really,
right.
you know, well, something like that could. So. I was very much an advocate of that back in the 60s and 70s when I was struggling with it. And then, of course, they went to the, what did they call it, the lottery,
mm-hmm.
Which at least lets you know one way or another.
Right.
And then, of course, phased it out.
Right.
Politically, I don't think it's going to come back anytime soon, though.
I think we have another caller on the line. Caller, welcome aboard with Greg Tucker.
Yes, I wanted to tell you how very much I enjoyed the show, and I also agree with that lady about the draft because I spent 3 years in the Navy as a draftee. But my question is for Mr. Tucker, and I'm an old guy, as you can probably tell, But am I wrong? Was it either his father or his uncle that threw the winning touchdown in the Tennessee Tech game about 40-41 to Billy Birch?
That was my father, Bernie Lee Tucker. He threw the pass. Billy Birch caught the pass, and shortly thereafter, they were both in the South Pacific. Birch was one of the first of the new pilots coming in to score. I think he shot down two or three Japanese planes very early in the conflict. And my father got his four planes and three probables about a year later. But there's several stories have been written. I've written one about the what they call the Fighting 40s team that won that game. And then every single man on the team disappeared into the military service.
Wow.
Because that was 1940, and by the end of 41, we were very much in the war. So.
You talk about how we've been affected by the wars since then. Of course, we had Korea and Vietnam, and then the wars in the Mideast. But of course, the media plays beats this one just like it does on a lot of other things. In that all the young men that are over there and sacrificing, and there are, and my hat's off to every one of them, but. We weren't affected near as much in any of these wars as we were World War II. I mean, it was just right. Devastating to communities.
Right. I've heard stories about the flag with the stars on it. I have still the flag that my grandmother was given that had two blue stars on it, showing that she had two boys in the service. The ones that... are more rare, fortunately, but also were very sad, was the Gold Star. Mm-hmm. And they even have had tributes to the Gold Star mothers. If you saw in the window the Gold Stars, you knew that mother had lost a son or in the war, had been killed in the war. You remind me, talking about the game in which my father threw the pass to Billy Birch. Just last Saturday, I got a phone call from an individual in France who is doing a documentary on Robert Sarvis, who was one of the linemen that protected my father when he was doing his passing, who disappeared and for the longest time was missing in action. They didn't know what had happened to him. Several reports that he had died in the D-Day invasion. He was a pilot. We solved the mystery of what happened to him about a year ago with the help of a lot of people in the internet. And the person who called me actually lived in the area where his plane had crashed, and they're doing a documentary that'll be on the European television circuit. Hopefully it'll come over here on Robert Sarvis. At MTSU, they call him one of the fallen veterans. But he was one of the first to get into action out of that football team because he had dual citizenship. He was also a citizen of Canada, and Canada through Great Britain was in the war a year ahead of the United States. So he left college, went up into Canada and joined and got assigned to the Canadian Air Force. He ended up flying for the Royal Air Force out of Britain, flying the big Lancaster, the bomber that was retaliating against Germany. And if you're familiar with that period of the war at all, those planes were going down in droves. They were big lumbering jet planes.
They were targets.
I mean, not jet planes. They were big lumbering bomber planes.
Right.
They had the nose gunner and the tail gunner and the top gunner, but they were just turkeys, you know, like a turkey shoot. He and his crew had survived D-Day. They survived about 4 weeks of daily flights in there. And then on one flight, they got badly shot up by the Germans. And Sarvis managed to take over the controls himself. He was the captain. To get the plane down in low altitude, lumbering along on what little power he had left, and held it steady enough for every one of his crew to bail out. Mm-hmm. And they all survived. But coming in low back over France, he went over some of the Allied anti-aircraft positions. And, of course, here's a plane coming over that is not on any flight schedule, is the unexpected, and it was at night, and he got shot down by friendly fire. He's the only one that died in the plane. The plane crashed in the night, and the next morning, the American military had guys driving bulldozers. If you can imagine all the different things you need to stage ground war, and it was their job to keep the roads open. They just came across this wreckage. They pushed it off into a swamp, and it disappeared. And it was 1994 when they found that wreckage.
It makes you wonder what happened to all the information from all of his crew. Once they got back, they knew a lot about, you know, what happened. How in the world could that have been lost? Because that was a heroic situation.
Yeah, they all bailed out. He went for another 50 or 60 miles, and, of course, he was not on any flight pattern that they could trace. And then when the wreckage of the plane disappeared, with most of him still in it, mm-hmm. and the story is kind of gruesome, they found an arm and buried it, not knowing whose it was.
Mm.
And later, the FBI, using fingerprints that had been taken from it, figured out whose it was. And then, of course, in the 1990s, when they found the wreckage of the plane, they found his remains there. And he's now buried with high honors in a French cemetery over there. But now we know for sure, you know, what happened to Robert Sarvis.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Greg Tucker.
Did you know a vehicle you buy from Stan McNabb Chevrolet, Cadillac, Buick, GMC, and Stan McNabb Jeep, Dodge, Chrysler in Tullahoma, and even Stan McNabb Ford in Lewisburg, and a vehicle you buy from another dealership, they may look alike, but the truth is, they're very different. Only the new or pre-owned vehicle from Stan McNabb has oil changes and tires for life at no additional charge. Check it out at stanmcnabb.com. See dealer for complete details.
Are you thinking about retirement living for yourself or a loved one? Think Adams Place in Murfreesboro. Retirement and assisted living, rehabilitation, and long-term care are available on their picturesque campus. Think it's too expensive? Think again. Adams Place Assisted Living starts as low as $100 a day. If you need a vacation, take advantage of assisted living's respite care for your loved one. Adams Place Retirement Community in Murfreesboro. Senior living at its finest.
The Truman Show now continues on the voice of Rutherford County, WGNS, AM and FM.
Today's guest, Greg Tucker.
Are you talking to me, Greg? Brian?
Not really.
I love all those little hints you give me, or cues, or whatever you call them.
It was that deer in the headlights look that you gave me that I thought you were asking.
That's my normal look, big boy.
About how much time you had left?
Yeah,
about a couple minutes.
And we've only got 2 minutes.
Did we have a caller waiting? Or?
No, everybody has seemed satisfied with all of your answers today.
Well, now, earlier, Truman made reference to Life and Death Matters, and we were talking about getting ahead on my research. It's not an awkward subject, but it's very much part of our history, and I've been doing research on executions, legal.
That is something we're going to have to spend a whole hour on.
Yeah, and what I thought was interesting right off to start with is that was the responsibility of the sheriff. And but you insisted that was before you came along.
I don't think that is something that I would want to be responsible for. I know that everybody's got this macho way about them. They said, well, I'll hang him or I'll pull the switch on him. But when you're taking a life, no matter what type of, and I hate to say use this word, monster the person may be,
right?
It's still an awesome responsibility, and you know that you're the one that's doing it.
Well, I think in the early days of Rutherford County, very quickly, it was the responsibility of the county up until about the 1900s. I'll try to pin that date down. If someone was found guilty of a capital crime, mm-hmm. and sentenced to capital punishment, it was the duty of the county. And, of course, they delegated that immediately to the sheriff. And I think, and not to make light of it at all, but I think they appreciated even then that this was an unusual request to be made, because mm-hmm. the sheriff received a bonus payment, $12.50.
Mm.
And in addition to that, he was allocated.
That made it even worse.
Yeah, in addition to that, well, we're talking $1,800. but he also was allocated $5 to build a gallows, mm-hmm. because they did not have a gallows standing by. Every time there was an occasion, they built a new gallows. And then there was $5 allocated for the shroud or the casket.
Isn't it funny how more sensitive we are about those things than the way it used to be? Because back many, many years ago, we're talking about in the 1800s, it would draw crowds like a state fair when you would have a hanging. People would make money off of it, selling for drinks and eats and things like that. They come from everywhere.
Right.
And then they went from that was too horrible, so they went to the electric chair and other means, drugs. And they're so sensitive because they don't want the person to suffer, even though he's being executed. And I think that's kind of... It's funny how that we evolve over the years into a more, I don't know if it's a more caring society, but we are different. And Greg, it's been another great show.
I enjoy it always,
Jim. Oh, it's always fun when you're on. It's like old home week for me. And I'm one of those people that I can, I'm like a kid sitting at the foot of someone like say Uncle Remus or somebody like that. I love to hear the stories, and they just kind of just flow over me, and I have more fun, believe it or not, listening than I do reading. Maybe it's not as much work, or I don't know, but maybe you have a little bit more Hollywood in you than what you think you do.
Well, yeah, you're in the right medium, because I think there are a lot of people out there that enjoy listening that might not take the time to read.
You know, I wonder if people enjoy us as much as they do Brian. You know, he follows us, and it used to be that that to be in a good slot in television, you had to have a really popular show to either come before or after.
Oh, it has to be before. You know, they're all settled in and just enjoyed a good show, and then you can come on with whatever your filler may be.
And he can relax and just enjoy the glory of it all.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we're glad that you have that opportunity, Brian, and we have enjoyed the show, and I'm sure that they're going to enjoy you almost as much.
Almost. Well, and people can listen anytime now, by the way. All of these shows are podcast online.
Tell me, how do you do that? Because I've had a lot of people asking.
Just go to WGNSradio.com, click on the podcast link, look for The Truman Show, and all the shows are being archived right there. You can download them. You can listen to them right there on the website, or you can download them to your computer and burn your own CDs and whatever.
Are they archived by date or name of guest?
They are in there by date and the guest who is on the show. So today's, we'll say July 12th, 2011, Greg Tucker.
And then yours will be the same right after this. They'll want to hear yours. And
there's
and
a podcast section.
So they'll be on.
And Action Line and all the high school games. And we're also going to podcast MTSU football, basketball, and coaches shows.
Oh, that's amazing.
My goodness. So.
All right. We finally caught up with the times.
Keeping up with the Joneses. Isn't that what they call it?
Well, you know, this didn't happen until Bart came back. So I knew he would set this place straight.
Yeah, he certainly did.
We'll see you tomorrow at 2 o'clock, and Shirley Ferris Jones will be our guest.